The challenge is we have a whole group of people where there is immense talent in our socioeconomically disadvantaged areas that we need to do a better way of elevating the talent that's in those systems that are creative and critical thinkers from a very early age. And I think, you know, the more that we focus on transforming the system that way versus what we have is 100 years of data that shows that the current system's not doing
working.
That.
Yeah.
No.
Access and opportunity. No. Those are two of the big sure. ones. Give them access and give them the opportunity. If you teach them that they can do it like you are, you know, look out. The world is a better place because of what you're doing it.
And when you believe that in yourself, you'll go out and build your social capital.
Mm-hmm.
The social capital in a community like mine is instrumental in future job opportunities and workforce, but you can teach kids how to build social capital.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Brighter Together podcast. My name is Janet Courtney, and my special guest today is Mark Odsather. Mark is the superintendent at Pleasant View Elementary School District in Poplar, California. Mark, it is so great to have you here today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
All right. Well, I've got some notes, and we talked a little bit before we started, but it sounds like you got some really cool stuff going on at your school, and I know our listeners will be excited to hear about it.
Yeah, we've gone through an amazing transformation over the last decade plus. So I've been here 27. I think this is my 27th year. I started as a teacher, and then moved into administration and the superintendent role in 2010.
Oh, wow. You're a unicorn.
Unicorn. yeah. Especially, I think the average, duration of a superintendency is, not very long in this country for sure. But I was fortunate enough to meet some people along the way that gave me great insight into like what education could look like differently. And so we set out on a path over a decade ago to transform the practice of education for the practitioners in it and for kids. But we knew that we had to change the practice of education because it's the rigid structures that have been in place for the last 150 years haven't allowed us as educators and teachers to really connect to our purpose, the purpose-driven work that I think we were all called to do. So our classrooms, if you walk into them today, don't look anything like a traditional public school. Or even, I would argue, most charter schools. We have open classrooms, TK through 8th. So the walls are gone. We may have 50 kids in a grade level with 3 teachers, 2 aides, and their day is somewhat determined based on that continuum of skills development. But a lot of it's based on projects that the kids create, along with one of the things that makes us kind of unique is that we've focused on financial literacy projects directed and guided by the kids where they create their projects. And this is from TK all the way up to 8th grade.
Wow.
And we're really focused on building kids that will be successful in life and the world they walk into. Not, I don't care so much about school. Like, I hate to say it, but like school's not that big of a deal to me. Learning is.
Right.
And sometimes I don't think those two things go hand in hand. And I grew up in a really affluent area in this country in the Northwest. And I can tell you firsthand that school was something that people in my community looked past in the sense that you just do it, but that's not what's going to make you successful. What's going to make you successful are these skills.
Mm-hmm.
And they're considered soft skills in a lot of situations. And the research is clear in the last 100 plus years that the soft skills are more important to well-being and life readiness and success. But yet somehow schools focus too heavily on hard skills and test scores and
because
we just
they're
don't.
Forced to, right? To a certain
yeah,
extent.
Yeah, I think they think they are. Like,
oh, okay.
It's not that we disregard it. We know that we still are going to be held, like, that we have to do those things. I wouldn't necessarily say held accountable to it because we actually did some focus group work with our families and our community, which we are one of the most impoverished areas in the United States. So in 2 major studies in the last 20 years coming out of Hurricane Katrina and so on, the east side of Tulare County was labeled as the most impoverished in the nation, which we sit right on the east side. We went through the big drought in 2013 through 15. So we're dealing with the kids that are at high risk. And we decided that we were just going to change the system and change it for teachers, right? Because so many teachers, I think we lose close to 46% of new teachers in the first 5 years, which is problematic. They are not feeling connected to a service-driven world, which is where we felt a calling to go do something to help and encourage kids. And Pleasant View is an amazing, I refer to it as the Pleasant Verse. Like, it's an alternate reality.
Nice.
And We have a lot of people that come visit and stuff, and we don't publicize too much what we're doing because education is so deeply rooted in some of those structures. It's difficult to get people to understand why we need to make these shifts and changes.
Yeah.
Teachers get it. The minute teachers come on campus, they get it. They understand it right away. So
tell us what a typical day looks like then.
So our kids in the mornings are usually broken up and kind of deploy out to teachers for, we call it TRI, our targeted reading instruction time. So we look at the continuum of skill development for like literacy development. And the only reason why we have grade levels is because somebody put a line through the standards development as a continuum.
Yeah. How much can a child learn in that year? And that's
yeah.
That grade,
and then we
right?
cut it off, yeah. which mm-hmm. is, which puts limitations on our kids, right? Like,
yeah,
and
sure.
so we look at, and so our kids get deployed out based on where they are on the continuation, that continuum of skill development. And then when they'll go to math and do math for that. And it's the same thing. We deploy out on some days, but then the rest of the day is pretty much tied to project-based learning. So, kids creating their own projects, they're actually using AI to co-design their own projects. Teachers then just focus on building the skills, that the skills can be the same across the projects, but our kids design a lot of their learning. And then I partnered with a group out of Brazil about 4 years ago to bring them to the United States. So the group out of Brazil was instrumental in building the Lumiar schools, which the Lumiar schools were built by a man, successful businessman down there, Ricardo Semlar. And they were a democratic model of schooling. So kids could decide what they wanted to learn about. I think they fired Ricardo a couple times from running the school and then they hired him back. But
that's awesome.
I was introduced to them. I was down at Da Vinci Schools in Los Angeles and happened to meet them and convince them to come work with me to build the education system of the future in Poplar, California. And so they did. In the last 4 years, we've worked really closely together to build in the financial literacy projects for our kids. And our kids are now they've done some amazing things. It's incredible to watch. But like we had a group of 2 years ago that decided, third graders decided they wanted to travel the world. So they researched different locations around the world. They filled out passport applications. They made their own passports. They created a travel budget to go to their locations, which they chose like Sydney, Australia, New York, Paris, Seoul, South Korea, which I thought was really interesting.
Mm,
and
mm-hmm.
then they in groups, they created a budget to raise money for their virtual trip. And the teachers dressed as pilots. The kids were walking to school with their suitcases, boarded their plane, flew to their location, went through baggage check, had to get their bags, had to get a visa. And then they went to a restaurant that was organized by the teachers to use their currency. They had to do currency conversion. And then
mm-hmm.
Bakersfield Airport actually let the kids come down. They took them through TSA, issued them tickets, took them out onto the runway so they could watch a plane land. Like, and then last year, our third grade decided that they wanted to learn about sound, which I thought was really interesting. And so we tied the financial literacy skills into that in terms of building prototype sound devices. The kids went down to the LA Zoo and they charted amplitudes of sound waves of different animals. Then they came back and they went to Cal State Stanislaus 3D Fab Lab to produce the parts for drums. And then the kids assembled the drums and played the drums at the Christmas program.
Wow.
And
that's
they all
amazing.
Tied to financial literacy skills.
Yeah.
And then we have a tool that we use that we basically archive it all like a digital portfolio. So they have this tool that was used in the Lumiar schools. So when I say we're completely different, like we're a testimony to the fact that like public schools can change. And I've had a number of people reach out to me about like from Brazil. And even I was working with somebody that sits on the United Nations Human Rights Council about can we create a model and replicate it? And my answer is no. Like
it's
everything we've done here is built on process. So we're not a model you can replicate in the sense of like we have a lot of different processes we use to do what we're doing. But our classrooms are amazing places of kids talking and moving around. And we also do Padea seminars. So we partnered with the Padea Institute out of North Carolina coming out of pandemic because we felt kids need to learn how to use their voice and they need agency over their own voice and they need to learn how to listen and have civil discourse, which we seem to have lost in this country.
Yeah, for sure.
And so our kids do 2 Padea seminars a month. They do these really rich Socratic seminars and it's been amazing to watch. And we see our kids going off and doing amazing things when they I always get asked, like, what is it like when they go to high school? Because it's such a different system.
That was one of my questions. Yeah, that was my next question for you. Is how does that translate for them when they get to high school?
They recognize it for what it is, which is a compliance system, right? Like, I just have to do this. The teacher wants me to do this, so I'll do this, and that's all I have to do. But they don't look at that as whether or not they're smart or capable. Or we actually had a kid, one of our kids was up for Businesswoman of the Year, and as an eighth grader, she had started her own business. I've had numerous kids go into high school and start their own pastry businesses or bakery businesses or car detailing businesses. We had a kid as a sophomore that took over his family finances and then came back right before graduation to let us know that they had just bought their first home as a family because he had been investing their money for the last 2 years. And then he came back 3 months later to let us know that they had bought their first rental income property. And I asked him, are you going to go to college? And he's like, I might take some real estate classes. And I'm like, yeah, you're good.
Yeah.
So,
that the world of getting a high school education and going off to college is not the reality of what needs to happen. And you look at the entrepreneurs and the really wealthy people, the majority of them are not college graduates.
So, no, and that's the neighborhood I grew up in. So I grew up in Medina, Washington, which Medina is home to Bill Gates' house was two blocks from me. Like it's like the Microsoft millionaire Weyerhaeuser, you name it, Nordstrom family. Like I grew up around that. And we were all told we were going to be very successful in life. But I don't know that my friends and I were much smarter than the kids I'm working with.
No,
right?
it's about just, there was an expectation. Opportunity.
Yeah.
Access
absolutely.
And opportunity.
Building social capital and self-efficacy, which I focus heavily on. Like, we had an efficacy in our neighborhood that we just believed we were going to be successful. And my kids can believe the same thing.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So our focus a decade ago was, can we create a very transparent, collaborative practice where the practitioners are driving the work? And we believed that lateral accountability would develop, leading to the self and collective efficacy of all learners growing and developing, which is what we've seen. It's not a theory anymore. Like, it's actually happened.
You've made it. Yeah, you've made
it. We have, for sure.
Wow. So how many kids do you have in your school right now?
So we are 400 and about 40 kids, TK through eighth grade. 30% of them are inter-district now, so they're coming from the more affluent neighborhood in town out to this really impoverished community to go bring their kids to school. And again, we don't publicize a ton of what we're doing because I don't think it's a difficult lift for parents to understand it, but it's a challenge for people in education to understand why we're doing what we're doing. Because it's our mental models of the system are so different. It's based on what we went through. And it's a big shift.
Well, and you're teaching to your kids strengths too, you know, and interests. I don't talk about it very often, but you know, my kids went to public school for each one of them went for a part of their beginning years, and then we homeschooled for 8 years. And I have three, and I'm an SLP. I'm a teacher, naturally a teacher. I was so afraid when I started with my youngest was a kindergartner, and he went to public school for kindergarten. And I was like, he's got to go to public school because I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to teach him how to read. How silly is that? Like, I'm an SLP. But that was my fear. And so he ended up going half day to public school, and then he would come home, and we would do how to teach your child to read in 100 easy lessons. If you're a homeschool parent, you know it. A lot of parents have used it. So after he came home from public school, I did how to teach your child to read in 100 easy lessons and taught my child how to read. And then we homeschooled from there. And then as they got bigger, we chose to put them back into public school at different times based on their needs. And, you know, my youngest went back in eighth grade because he wanted to play football, and he's my little social bunny. And, you know, they're all grown now, but all of them went back into a public school at one point or another in their career, based on where their interests were and what they wanted to do. And my middle son did career center, and my daughter just wanted to experience her senior year in high school and those kinds of things, you know, the prom and all of those things. But it's the same. You're doing it. Just reminds me of what I did as a homeschool mom, in that we found projects that helped them to learn, got excited about things that they were excited about, and learning happens in such a diverse way. You know, you never stop learning. You know, one of the things that I've heard over the pandemic was learning loss. You know, the kids lost all this time for learning. And I'm like, kids don't stop learning. They just didn't learn what we wanted them to learn, right? They kept learning. They learned how to survive when their parents had to go to work and they had to feed themselves, or, you know, how to survive when whatever the situation was. But they did that, and those are the experiences that they took out of COVID, whatever, positive or negative. But kids don't stop learning just because we stop teaching them, right?
No, in fact, I don't know that they learn much that we traditionally teach them anyhow, but learn and forget. It's funny, we had an eighth grader last year that decided he wanted to learn. They were doing states of matter, and he wanted to learn why certain popcorn kernels don't pop. And so he did this whole thing where he could explain everything around the starch and the steam and the, you know, and how it, the change of matter in the states of matter of a kernel and why certain kernels don't pop. And it was like, it was tied to his interest, and he went deep. And what I always try to explain to people is, like, curriculum for my kids is a constraint. And the reason why is the world is so much bigger and broader, and it's hard when we constrain it to just one book and one text, versus the projects tend to go very broad and wide, like the sound project. My kids could tell you about amplitudes of sound waves, have different colors, have different frequencies. Like this was third grade.
Right.
My fourth graders they decided to run like business trucks, like trucks. And so the kids actually, some kids did like a dog grooming truck. Other kids did a nail truck. Some kids did food trucks, and they had budgets, and they had to create budgets and look at inventory controls and like all this. And then we actually had a food truck come out for the day. Our kids ran it for the staff for the day.
Oh, fun.
So like, but you talk about the breadth of experiences and language that's a part of that.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. I always tell people that, like, if education K-12 is one time around a track, 400 meters, based on the zip code I was born in, I started at the 350.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Compared to where my kids start. And so if we expect them to be at the same finish line at the same point in time, that's not fair at all to our teachers, our educators, and our kids. And the reality is, I can still give my kids a world-class education by opening the world to them and not constraining them to. And that's where conversations with educators can get difficult, because again, the mental model of education is one way, and it's the way we all experienced it. But learning and education, again, this is where I don't necessarily think they agree. And I do believe that self-efficacy is a stronger indicator of success and life readiness. Like, you have to believe that you can learn anything, and you have to believe in your abilities, even when there's setbacks. So,
well, and one of the things I always said was, you teach, when you're a homeschool parent, you teach your children how to learn. And then they learn what they want to learn. My youngest, again, I'll go back to him. He's I literally will say to him, honey, I want the best of this thing, whatever it is. And he researches it for me. He gets down into it because he does it all the time. Anything that he's interested in, he researches it like crazy. He's 23 now, and he's actually just joined the Air National Guard, and he's going to basic training in March. And then he's got his tech school after that. He aced the ASVAB. The entire job list was open to him at Selfridge in Detroit, because he lives in Michigan and I'm down here and I miss him. But because he really researched, which branch do I want if I want to do this? He wants to fly. And he's like, I want to fly, Mom. And in order to fly and to get into to get the government to pay for it, I have to have an education. And so, he's just researched, because that's what you're teaching them to do. You're teaching them whatever it is that they love, that's the thing. And you and I both know this. If you do what you love, you don't work another day in your life, right?
Yeah. So, and you don't. Yeah. Yeah. And I think to your point, it's interesting, because on our website, we have a little documentary we did back in 2018, which was really even prior to some of the major shifts we've made in the last 5 years. But it was called Teaching to Learn. Mm-hmm. Because this idea of that we want to teach people how to learn, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Education's different. Right. And this is where I get the two. And I don't necessarily agree that we're really doing a great job of educating kids in this country when we should be teaching them how to learn, which, to your point about your son, is he believes he can learn, because he's very interested in it. He'll go find the avenues and he'll knock on the doors and open the right pathways. And that's the piece that I think when you come into our system and you get to see what our kids are doing, it actually is a very emotional experience for a lot of school systems. We do instructional rounds 6 times a year. Richard Elmore, who is the head of the Graduate School of Education at Harvard, and Liz City, who are the authors of that book, I happened to meet in 2010. Liz still comes out on campus once a year, works with me quite a bit, actually released her brand new book in April last year on campus. Richard was the head of the Graduate School of Education, but a big thinker. And him and I had lots of conversations around the work that him and Sagata Mitra had done. And Sagata is the guy who put a bunch of computers in the walls of the slums of Mumbai in India, of an office building. The kids taught themselves molecular biology. Yeah, and these are kids with no education.
Isn't that crazy?
And so there's an amazing movie on Amazon Prime now called Radical. And it's the story of a teacher in Matamoros, Mexico, who did the same thing that we're doing, but he did it in his classroom and got amazing results from his kids. We're just doing it on a systemic level, and we've been able to do it on a systems level.
There's a big difference between being supported by somebody who's walked in your shoes and someone who hasn't. At Lighthouse Therapy, our leadership team is made up of experienced clinicians who've actually worked in schools. We understand the pressure you're under and what real support looks like. That's why our therapy solutions, whether it be virtual, hybrid, or in-person, are built with you in mind. No complicated systems or red tape, just streamlined support and seasoned therapists who are ready to make a difference. Learn more at lighthouse-therapy.com/brighter together.
Yeah, so. And you're changing, your kids will change the community. You must be seeing some of that already.
Yeah, I always joke half-heartedly that, like, I'm okay with the other education systems not changing because my kids are going to need employees someday to work for them, because that's the mindset of our kids, is that they're going to end up running their own businesses, and they're going to have that entrepreneurial mindset, which a lot of my friends that I grew up with, that's the mindset they had. And many of them went on to run major businesses and are CEOs. But I'm going to be honest with you, I don't know that they ever scored well on state tests. I don't know that they were not 4.0 students. Like, so again, I think where we tend to put value, and I was reading some research recently on, like, at 7 years old, those tests that we give 7 years old are just as predictive as any tests we give them K-12. And again, it had 60-70% of it's socioeconomic, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, and we need to have an honest conversation in this country about what we're assessing. The challenge is soft skills are more qualitative in measurement. So it's harder to assess those things. It's easier to say it's a hard skill, but we believe we have a tool that shows, because the tool we use that we brought from Brazil, the Mosaico, is a disc that is a digital portfolio of a kid's whole learning journey. So TK through 8, instead of my mom who put it up on the refrigerator with a magnet, like my work, we have the ability to archive this in a disc and show a child's whole journey of learning through their educational path at Pleasant View.
How do you handle special education students?
Good luck finding them in our class. They're right in the middle of doing all of it.
Are they awesome?
That's the amazing thing about our classrooms, is our special ed students are right in the middle of it. And you wouldn't be able to pick them out, like, regardless of what those disabilities may be. They're doing the same work. They're working on the same projects, albeit it's scaffolded with them and the special ed teachers. They come in, and a lot of times people think co-teaching as special ed plus gen ed, but the way we co-teach, it's you'd have a hard time picking out the teacher in the room with the instructional aid. It's a group of adults working together to meet each kid's needs.
Wow.
So
that's so cool.
Yeah.
That is so cool. So how do you handle, you still have to do state testing, right? I mean, are you mandated? You're mandated, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think we have to think it's important.
Yeah. No, I get that.
So we
but you
take
still have
it.
To, you just do it and you move on.
Yeah. A lot of schools will make a big deal. They'll celebrate. We don't. We actually give the NWEA map 3 times a year, and we do that to kind of check on growth targets and kind of if kids are growing. And that's how we kind of, that's the data we use. The state test to me is it's an indicator of what we already know, which is the socioeconomic status of our kids and where they start versus where kids in other areas start. So we give it, but we put no value and focus in. And the interesting thing is, I had a conversation with a group of superintendents a while back, and they're, Mark, what about the test scores? And, you know, the test scores are important. And I'm like, they haven't been important in 50 years of doing it. Like, we've been standardized testing for four decades, and the only people that care about that stuff are educators. And we celebrate that we're moving forward, but yet still 60 to 70% of kids aren't on what we call grade level. So we don't put a lot of emphasis on that, because I also think to my teachers, it's unfair, because day one, they know they're not going to meet that standard come May. So it's unfair to say that you're going to make 80% of your kids proficient all of a sudden by May. And we know this isn't, and again, 40 to 50 years of testing, this isn't Mark's personal opinion.
No,
this is based on the data.
Oh, I rail a bit on the show all the time about how schools
are setting teachers up to fail.
Yeah.
And I don't want my teachers to think that the impact they're having on this world is tied to some archaic test.
Some number.
No,
and based on whether or not that child had a good night's sleep and had a full belly and felt safe and all of those other factors that are going to affect those scores as
Our focus is build relationships with kids and families. And when we did our focus groups, our parents were very clear to us. Academics was fourth.
Mm-hmm.
Health and safety of their kids was number one. They want their kids to be loved. They want them to be known, seen, and heard. And it's the same thing our kids want. And it's the same thing my teachers want to do for their children and families. So if we just changed that in this, our profession, and turned it over to teachers to lead that way, we would have a much different system. Teachers inherently want to do right by kids and want to grow and learn. Mm-hmm. We pit them against each other. I played basketball at a high level. I played professionally over in Europe. And like, I understand competition on the sports field. Saying this school is doing better based on an archaic test score of some sort and pitting people against each other in a profession where we should be collaborative and working together to solve each. We all have the same issues for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me makes no sense. And maybe I'm just too old. And
I don't care about it at this point. Yeah. I mean,
we've talked about
test scores. We talked about how messed up the funding is and how difficult it is and you know, different places and different ways. And it's true. And I love the fact that you're willing to come on my show and talk about it. Thank you very much, because it matters, because what you're doing is groundbreaking. Even though you've been doing it for 15 years, you've got the data to prove that it works. And I hope that there's people out there that go, hey, what if we did that in our school? You know, how would we make that work in our school? Can we make it work? You can if you want to. You have to fight for it. I'm sure you had to fight for it.
Yeah, you have to. I think the challenge is you have to give people enough like calibration experiences to see what they're currently producing and then what could we do to move that. And if you're patient, I think sometimes we sell, Richard Elmore and I always, and Liz City, I give them a ton of credit as mentors in my journey. We talked about change a lot, and Richard would always impart on me that change is held in two different places. One, if you want to change what you're doing, you just change it. You don't wait 6 months or a year from now, you just make the change. But then the other part of that, which I think is the one that most systems have the hardest time with, which is change is generational. Meaning when we brought in Padea seminars, yes, it was going to have an impact on my sixth, seventh, and eighth graders right as they left the system. But the greatest impact would be my TK kids doing it for 9 years before they left me. And it is the kids now coming up into our junior high that have been doing seminars for the last 3 or 4 years. It looks completely different for them than it did for the kids that started at grade 6 or 7. So that idea that like we're always new iterations take generations for change, and we're never that patient in education. Instead, we focus on programs, that a program is going to fix you in 3 years, and that's not realistic. And that's why teachers get burnt out on, and they'll say the pendulum shifts, and I don't think it shifts. I think we just, I heard, and this alarmed me coming out of the pandemic, I heard so many superintendents talking about SEL programs, like a program. And to me, it's like, start with building relationships with your kids and loving on kids. Like, start there. Like, I get you might want a program for some resources and everything, but the program doesn't come first.
Right.
The program comes second. The relationship with the child, the human element, comes first, and it has to.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
there's nothing like stepping in as a speech therapist and seeing kids and having that relationship with them. And I'm thousands of miles away sometimes, you know. I mean, you're in California, I'm in Texas, and you log in to my room and you're a child that I know, and I know there's something wrong. The second I see you, I'm like, and I've said this before on the show, every single plan that I had for that session goes out the window, because I look at your face and I go, Mark, what's wrong? Because you might not be in the same place. You have a different look on your face. You have a difference in body, you know, just the whole demeanor. You get to know your kids and you can see those changes immediately because, and you know, sometimes they don't come because there's something going on, but you know your kids when you have a relationship. And I had 55 kids. That's a lot. I mean, I know there are SLPs that do way, way more than that, but as a teletherapist at that time, 55 kids was my max. And I knew each one of them intimately because that's what you do as a teacher. You get to know your kids and you love on them. And they know that the first thing you've got to do is you've got to find that thing that they love. I always called it the hook. What is my hook for that child to get them interested in being in therapy and to want to be here? You know, because if we can do those things, I had a kid who WWE, I never knew anything about WWE, but boy, that year I learned a lot because that's what we talked about, because that's what he cared about, you know? And so I became an expert on WWE that year because we talked about it every single time he came to my, and he was a stutterer. So we, you know, it was all about just communicating. Let's get him to talk, get him to learn when he makes a mistake and working on it. And so that's what we did. And, you know, just those kinds of things. And you just have to understand
who
your kids are.
Yeah, I think there, and I know there was a study done at Yale on kids in relationship learn. Kids outside of relationship don't learn to the same extent that kids in relationship with the adult do. So to your point, like, if we really want our kids to be learners, the first and foremost, they have to know that we love them, we care about them. You know, we have to build that psychological safety in our classrooms and our communities of learners. And unfortunately, I see there's so many different toxic things that take place within school systems that for the people that need to be most impactful and focus on building relationships, they're pulled in different directions, told to do different things. And it doesn't feel like they have much. I talk a lot about fractals. So fractals are these, you know, reoccurring patterns at different scale. You know, similar patterns at different scale. And in education, the traditional fractal for the last 150 years has been command and control. So I tell you what to do. You tell teachers what to do. Teachers tell kids what to do. And we have completely shifted that fractal. I always joke that we're more of a Jackson Pollock drip painting. So there's a lot of chaos in there, right? Like they are fractals, you know, but there's a lot of openness and it's different for different kids in different classrooms and different grade levels and teachers. And we're all learners in this system that have a ton of autonomy, but there's coherence, meaning that we all agree to do things together as a staff when we're moving forward with our learning and implement things in our classrooms. So we reduce some of the variability that takes place in a lot of our school systems, for sure.
Wow. Very good. Well, Mark, where do people, I know people are going to have questions for you. They absolutely are. Where do they go to learn more about Pleasant View Elementary School District and Mark?
Well, I would definitely go to our webpage, the www.pleasant-view.org. There is a documentary on there called Teaching to Learn that they can watch. And it gives you kind of an insight as to where Pleasant View was headed back in 2018. Like, we're looking at doing a follow-up now because some of the kids in that video now, one of them is at UCLA. She's studying law. Another one is going to be a CPA. The other one started her own business, but we use some student voices in there. But I think to get an idea of what it may look like, I don't think anything, me talking about it doesn't do it justice. So, I mean, if anybody's in California and wants to stop by and see it, I would recommend that's probably the better way to go because it's a lot to take in. And this is what we hear from a lot of school districts, too. And I actually had somebody visit last year who was a tech entrepreneur, built a huge tech company. You would know it. But they told me they've worked in the charter school system and seen some of the most innovative schools in the country. And he told me, I have never seen a complete system until I came here.
Wow. Very cool.
Which was a great compliment to the work that my staff has done. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because you didn't do this by yourself. We know that. We know that. You had to convince a lot of people, and they have to buy in. You have to have that buy-in for something like this. And they obviously have, because you've been successful. So, and the kids are going to win ultimately. And that's the most beautiful out of all of it, is that your kids are going to win and they're going to be successful, and it's already happening. So congratulations on that. It's amazing. I have three very successful children because I taught them how to learn and gave them the confidence to know that, hey, and I've said it, and if you say anything to a child that's your own, you have to teach them that you can do anything. There are people that are always going to tell you no. There are going to always be people who don't believe in you, but you can do anything you set your mind to. So I'm telling you, as your mother, to go out and grab on to what you want in life, because you can do it. And my youngest, I think, took it to heart more than my two. They all work for me right now, but my youngest is, he wants to fly, like I said, and he's chasing it. Because he knows, and he's got that confidence. And I'm super proud. I'm a proud mama. I always will be. So, yeah. So.
Awesome.
So one last question. Yeah. So if you could, within your realm, and we don't want to, I don't want to talk about money, because there's never enough money. We know that. But if you could just miraculously fix one thing in your world, just one thing, what would it be? Just don't have to deal with it ever again.
Well, I think there, I'll give you one. I'll first say that I don't think money is the issue in education.
Yeah.
Like, I think we've organized adults around the work in the wrong way and kids around the work in the wrong way. And if we reorganize them in a different way, we're going to get different results. I will say that the one thing is the bureaucratic mess they put on schools. That burden, what I've seen in the last 15 years as superintendent, is it's more than quadrupled, the amount of paperwork and compliance stuff that the state requires that takes educators away from doing the meaningful work. And I don't see it. They never take anything away.
They just add more.
They somehow think that, like, we all have, like, I'm head of facilities too. So I work on construction projects, and I'm working on, you know, and I work with our transportation department, and some days I'll mow lawns when they let me on the tractor. And like, but the amount of stuff that we have to do in a small district, we wear so many hats that it takes away from the time that we could be spending working with teachers and working with kids, which is really where I think most educational leaders, that's really a passion piece for them, but it gets taken away from them. And then I see why people get frustrated with the system and bitter, and because they don't feel connected. Where I'm struggling with that mess of stuff that has to get done, and I can find time to go into classrooms and work with kids, I feel refreshed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. One of the hardest days for me was giving up seeing kids directly. But I can serve 20. We have 2,300 kids right now, and I could serve 55. So I'm empowering my team, and we do it differently. I mean, we do. I don't talk a ton about Lighthouse on here. I probably more than I think I do, but it's my passion. I mean, it's what I do. I love what we do. But we empower our therapists. Like, our mission is to be a therapy company run by therapists for therapists, for the betterment of students. And when you put those therapists in a place where they feel loved and supported, just like what you've done with your teachers, they can do anything. They can teach these kids and dismiss kids and love on kids and know that Lighthouse is going to support them through that, you know, and understanding that, it's a beautiful thing. And therapists are attracted to what we're doing because we care about people. We care about our clients that choose to use us. And we care about all of those kids. I never, ever talk about success in dollars. And I never, ever talk of success in number of sessions, because that's not how we win. We win with people. And so we talk of our success as the number of students that we've served, because that's what matters to us, is those kids.
It's funny because you say that, because I think schools, probably the most toxic place in most school systems would be the staff lounge, right? Like, and I think it's interesting because a decade ago, when we had all the curriculum in the world and all the extra materials, and the teachers had a pacing calendar, so it was all laid out for them all 5 days of the week for 180 days, I heard more complaining about people's jobs than I do today. And my teachers today they're creating all of this stuff, and they're working so much harder, but it's a passion thing for them.
Yeah.
And they see the results in what our kids are doing, and then kids, what they're doing with their lives. And that's this motivator that I don't hear the complaining that I heard a decade ago, but it's because they're connected to purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Like why they wanted to do this hard work to begin with, because when they got into it, they knew it was going to be hard.
Yeah. And when you're working towards something, when you have a true mission, you know, every company has a mission statement that's in a book somewhere. But when you have a mission that you're working on and people buy into that mission, it's a direction. It's an arrow. It keeps you on track. And Lighthouses, I mean, what I just said, our mission statement, every single person in this company, especially our management team, can tell you that mission statement because that's who we are. And Lighthouse started because I saw other companies that did not value their therapists, and that I'm like, you guys are doing a disservice to your students and to your clients by disregarding your therapists. And so that's why I did what I did. And I mean, God called me to it. I didn't just do this on my own. I'm blessed beyond measure, but I keep stepping into it and I keep doing, and this podcast is a piece of that. There are so many frustrating people out there that feel like they are not valued. And when we can talk to people like you who are doing amazing things, and there's so many different people that are doing so many amazing things in education that are getting beat up every single day by our media. So I'm putting my money where my mouth is and giving people an opportunity to hear stories like yours. It can be different. It can be better. You can be successful at this, but you've got to love on the kids. You got to love on the people that you're working with, and you know, and love on education. And let's keep talking about education, because it's our future. Our kids' future is education.
Absolutely.
And we need to value that in this country. And there are so many talking heads on television. I want to just read your. You don't even know what you're talking about. You're just looking at a number on a piece of paper, and that says we're failing. Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah. Yet we have one of the most creative societies in the world.
We do.
Right.
And
full of entrepreneurs and creative. Uh-huh. The challenge is we have a whole group of people where there is an immense talent in our socioeconomically disadvantaged areas that we need to do a better way of elevating the talent that's in those systems. That are creative and critical thinkers from a very early age. And I think, you know, the more that we focus on transforming the system that way, versus what we have is 100 years of data that shows that the current system's not doing
working.
That.
Yeah.
No.
Access and opportunity. No. Those are two of the big ones. Give them access and give them opportunity. And if you teach them that they can do it like you are, you know, look out. The world is a better place because of what you're doing.
And when you believe that in yourself, you'll go out and build your social capital.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The social capital in a community like mine is instrumental in future job opportunities and workforce. But you can teach kids how to build social capital.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
1,000%. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Mark, it's been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for being willing to come on and telling your story. And thank you for what you're doing for all of those kids and just keep going. I'm your cheerleader. Keep going. I love it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah. Take care.